asked myself, why was I, the chief of special ops, selected to travel to the South Pole at that time to do a job that any number of others could have done? And I wondered if it could have been because one of my routine duties, if I had been in Washington, would have been to arrange for additional security in Texas. So I decided to check it out. And sure enough, I found out that someone had told the 112th Military Intelligence Group at 4th Army Headquarters at Fort Sam Houston to stand down that day over the protests of the unit commander, Colonel Reich.
I believe it's a mistake.
This is significant because it is standard operating procedure, especially in a known hostile city like Dallas, to supplement the Secret Service. I mean, even if we had not allowed the bubble top to be removed from the limousine, we would have placed at least 100 to 200 agents on the sidewalk without question. I mean, only a month ago in Dallas, UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson was spit on and hit. There had already been several attempts on de Gaulle's life in France. We would have arrived days ahead of time, studied the route, checked all the buildings, never would have allowed all those wide open empty windows overlooking Dealey, never. We'd have had our own snipers covering the area. The minute a window went up, they'd have been on the radio. We'd have been watching the crowd, packages rolled up, newspapers, coat over and up. Never would have let a man open an umbrella along the way. Never would have allowed that limousine to slow down to 10 miles an hour, much less take that unusual curve at Houston and Elm. You would have felt an army presence in the streets that day. None of this happened. It was a violation of the most basic protection codes we have, and it is the best indication of a massive plot in Dallas. Now, who could have best done this? Black ops, Mr. Garrison. People in my business, people like my superior officer, could have called Colonel Reich and said, look, we have another unit coming from so-and-so, providing security. You'll stand down. I mean, that day, in fact, there were some individual Army intelligence people in Dallas. I'm still trying to figure out who and why. But they weren't protecting the client, and, of course, Oswald. Army intel had a Harvey Lee Oswald on file. But all those files have been destroyed. Many strange things were happening, and your Lee Harvey Oswald had nothing to do with them. Well, that's a real question, isn't it? Why? The how and the who is just scenery for the public. Oswald, Ruby, Cuba, the mafia. Keeps them guessing like some kind of parlor game, prevents them from asking the most important question, why? Why was Kennedy killed? Who benefited? Who has the power to cover it up? Who?
This is Red Eyes Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. Thank you for tuning in. Good to have you with us. We are coming to you from the west coast of Sweden, up in Scandinavia. You can find us 24/7 from around the world where internet is accessible through our website, redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. Glad to have you here. As you might have noticed, our last few programs have been a mini-series of sorts with speakers that are going to attend the Beyond Knowledge conference in Liverpool at the beginning of May. And today we are continuing with that tradition with author and conspiracy researcher Ken Thomas. He's the editor and publisher of Steam Shovel Press. He's written NASA, Nazis and JFK, and Mind Control. Also Oswald and JFK, and also together with Jim Keith, The Octopus, Secret Government, and The Death of Danny Casalero. Last year he was a speaker at the Conspiracy Con, and today we're going to discuss everything from The Octopus to Wilhelm Reich to UFOs, and if there's time we might also get into some interesting stuff about the Maury Island case, the UFO case. So there's lots to talk about, and we're short of time, so I want to get things going here as soon as possible. I do want to mention, though, before that, that Ken's website is steamshovelpress.com, steamshovelpress.com, where you can find a lot more information on his magazine, books, DVDs, and lots of articles. So with that, let's say welcome to our guest. Thank you for coming on, Ken. Nice to have you with us.
Henrik, hi. Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's nice to be here.
Superb. You know, if you will, for our listeners that are new to yourself or your material and research, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background in regards to conspiracy research, and also about the Steam Shovel magazine.
Okay. Well, I've been doing Steam Shovel. Well, the magazine is actually called Steam Shovel Press, and I've been doing it as a magazine since like 1992, and I've been kind of a presence on the global conspiracy culture world for all that time and for times preceding that. It kind of, the magazine kind of began as a book review newsletter, and at a certain point in time, major things were happening in the conspiracy counterculture in America. The great maven of conspiracy theorists, a woman named Mae Brussel, died, and one of the great magazines of the time called Critique, the founder of that magazine found a guru somewhere and converted his magazine all into the homilies of his guru. And all of this information, this underground information about conspiracies and so forth, it was a real threat that it was just going to stop happening. So I turned my little book review newsletter into a magazine. I did a call for papers telling everybody, hey, I'm here, let's keep this going, I'll produce this magazine, send me articles. And so like with its fourth issue, Steam Shovel became a zine, basically, a magazine. People kind of lose track of how information was carried back before the internet. It was, right, in a lot of ways, it was just distributed through these little things that were kind of offshoots of different kinds of fanzines, which were fan magazines.
Right.
There were zines, and there were a number of them. You know, my writing partner, Jim Keith, did one called Dharma Combat.
Right.
Greg Bishop did The Excluded Middle. A guy named Jim Martin did Flatland, you know, and I did Steam Shovel Press. They all kind of got almost nonsensical names. But the theme there,
right,
the theme for all of it was to carry on the work that had been done in different communities, a lot of it the JFK assassination community that had been going on for 30 years at that point.
Right.
And to present information from different points of view that contradicted the official record and promoted the idea that there are secret agendas and hidden histories and different kinds of information that is suppressed in the mainstream culture.
Nice, nice. Have you moved online basically now, or are you still giving out the magazine as a zine?
The last issue of the magazine was a little bit of both. There's, you know, it's still available in hard copy form, but I'm also circulating it as a PDF.
Right.
But for many years now, there has been steamshovelpress.com, which was kind of ancillary to the magazine. You know, a lot of editorial work and articles and stuff go on up there, basically for free. It's not a paid-for site, but you know, everything that's going on in between issues that we want to get out there, and that's been going on for a number of years. But it still exists as a magazine, and you can still subscribe to it and get it in the mail in hard copy form.
Mm. Do you send worldwide or only within the U.S.?
Worldwide, you know, as long as people are willing to pay for the overseas
shipping,
postal rates.
Right, right.
Yeah, so we've got, I do have readers all over the world, not as many as in the U.S., but it certainly gets out there.
Mm, excellent. You know, I would like to talk a little bit about some of the material in The Octopus, and as you mentioned, this is something that you wrote together with Jim Keith, and we had Jerry Smith with us on the program about a week ago now, and talked actually a little bit about Jim Keith. They were good friends, and were you as close as Jim and Jerry too?
Well, I think actually Jerry went to high school with Jim Keith.
Right.
Yeah, he was like a childhood friend. So I didn't know Keith that long. You know, Keith and I actually met in that realm I was just talking about, in the zine world. You know, as different people. I was publishing this magazine, and Keith was always looking for a different outlet for his writing. So that's how we knew each other. But, you know, so obviously I'm not as close to him as Jerry was if he went to high school with him.
Right, right.
But we did co-write this thing, you know, and in the middle of all that, or after it was all over, he died under very strange circumstances.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so
an interesting adventure in my career, I think.
Yeah, so, I mean, so what were some of the main things that you guys focused on in The Octopus? I know that the Innsloss scandal and, of course, the subsequent murder, then, I guess, of Danny Casalero was a big theme of the book, right?
That's right. What actually had happened was Casalero was working on a book himself that he called, he originally called it Behold the Pale Horse, which is actually a title that was later made famous by a guy named Bill Cooper.
William Cooper, yeah, sure. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Well, the original title of Casalero's book was Behold the Pale Horse, too, but he changed it to The Octopus.
Huh.
And he was accumulating all this information from various spy sources and mafia sources and underground figures involving the Inslaw case, the Promise software, and a whole bunch of other things. And his idea, the way he, I think the way he thought that he was going to get around, you know, the consequences of doing that kind of work was to fictionalize it. You know, he was writing a fictional novel. What he was presenting as a fictional novel after going out and doing all of this really hardball research into the spy world. And he figured if he presented it as fiction, then, you know, nobody would mind. But, of course, you know, the people that he was talking to didn't look at it that way. And he stepped on somebody's toes or, you know, pushed the envelope a little too far in one direction, and he was found dead in a hotel room in West Virginia with slashes in his wrists, with the official conclusion that it was a suicide. But before that happened, he had contacted his family members and his friends, and he said, look, they're on to me. If an accident befalls me or if something happens to me, don't believe it was an accident. Don't believe it was a suicide. They're out to get me. He told everybody that. And then what happened after he died, the majority of his research was deposited at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. And I just so happened to work in my daytime position as an archivist at the university, for actually that university, at its St. Louis branch. So here we had all of this fantastic behind-the-scenes research kind of dumped in our laps, you know. So I brought it to Keith. I was talking to Keith on a regular basis then. I said, well, what can we do with this? And Jim said, well, Jim's first idea was really basically to let's finish the book that he was going to write. You know, let's prove to them that they can't stop somebody from exposing all of this stuff. And what we wound up doing was not exactly that. Although in The Octopus, we do reproduce Casolaro's early drafts and his proposals and as much of the writing that was preserved in those notes. But we kind of add to that Casolaro's biography and then a whole bunch of research on our own that shows all the various tributaries of the scandals that he was investigating.
Right. That's weird, though, in a way, isn't it? That, I mean, a guy who's writing a fictional work at that time when there were so many other people around writing, you know, non-fictional work on many of the same subjects, right?
Well, actually, there wasn't really a lot of work on Inslaw or Promise. It began for Casolaro in one of his other day jobs. He used to write for computer trade magazines, and that's where the whole Promise software started up. You know, even to this day, Inslaw is kind of an obscure scandal of that time. People kind of look back and they think of Iran-Contra, maybe.
Right.
In that kind of thing. But Iran-Contra was actually more of an extension of the kind of dynamic that Casolaro had exposed with the Inslaw case. That is the sleeping with the enemy kind of thing, where America was actually cooperating with basically what we could conceive of as jihadist terrorists.
Right.
At the time. Yeah. So. So
that's the background on the Inslaw case. That is a clear connection with the Iran-Contra affair. Is that it?
Yeah. Well, you see, it actually really begins in 1980 when Casolaro basically reached the same conclusion that another guy, I think his name was Gary Sick, S-I-C-K, who wrote a book called The October Surprise.
Right.
And The October Surprise is the story of the Reagan campaign team having contacts with the Ayatollah Khomeini to hold on to the famous hostages, the 52 hostages of that time, until after Jimmy Carter lost the election. That's called the October Surprise.
Right.
And where it begins for Danny Casolaro after that is the man who made the payoff, the man who took the money for that little illegal conspiracy to subvert an American election and gave it to Khomeini. Made the payoff to Khomeini for doing that, was a guy named Earl Bryan. And his reward for paying off Khomeini was to be given something called the Promise software. And that's why everybody kind of focuses on this case, because the Promise software involves a super sophisticated surveillance software that kind of drives the Echelon satellite systems that spy on us and all sorts of other things. But it was given to Bryan so that Bryan could sell it to police agencies around the world, and this would include the CIA, The Mossad, Interpol, the ISI, all these people bought versions of the Promise software from Earl Bryan, and Earl Bryan profiteered from this, made a fortune selling this software.
Right.
Unfortunately, it had been stolen from a client of the government. It was actually developed by a company called InSlaw, and that's why this is known as the InSlaw case.
Right.
InSlaw had created Promise. Its origins actually were going back to the Vietnam War to track the Viet Cong. A guy named Bill Hamilton developed it, and he developed a version of it actually for the police board here in St. Louis.
Hmm.
And its whole point and purpose was to be able to effectively track the enemy, you know, whether it was the Viet Cong or whether it was, you know, a criminal through prosecutors, various prosecutors' offices. That's
right.
Why it's called PROMIS, the Prosecutor Management Information System.
Hmm.
So that you could tell, you know, if there was a criminal who had been picked up, you could tell where he was in the system, you could feed it all this information, and you could pretty much second guess his next move better than any kind of fortune teller. That was the great thing about the Promise software, was its prognostication capability, its ability to project the next thing an enemy might do.
Right, right. Wow, so this did, I mean, if you were selling this to all these different departments and so forth, did that mean that these departments could have access to what, even satellite footage and information coming from U.S. military systems, things like this?
Yeah, well, it's a very malleable code. You know, it's in several million lines of code, and it was used to do a number of things. They used to have difficulty tracking Soviet submarines through the Arctic ice, for instance. With the Promise software, made that a lot easier, the way they applied it there.
Hmm.
But the nefarious thing about the Promise software was that once it was sold to a client, it was sold with a backdoor capacity, a secret backdoor capacity. So that is, Earl Bryan, working, of course, for, you know, Western intelligence, Central intelligence, not necessarily the CIA, but working for the United States,
right,
was illegally selling and profiteering this software to its clients. And the clients were getting, not knowing it, were getting the ability for that Central Intelligence Agency, the U.S., to spy on them.
Right, right.
Or capacity. So, I mean, it serves them right because they were buying it illegally in the first place.
Well, exactly.
But in addition to profiteering from it, we got a whole system in which we could spy on other people spying on other people.
Oh, my God. So do you think that Earl Bryan then was a front actually used by the CIA or some kind of Western intelligence in this case?
The Octopus. He was working for the Octopus, right?
Right.
The Octopus was Casolaro's term for this power group that was a transnational power group that at its core had a bunch of people from the OSS after World War II who had come together basically to further their own greed and their own power interests above and beyond anything that anyone loyal to the United States would want to do, for instance. So a transnational conspiracy of global proportions.
Hmm. You know? And I guess,
you know, made Casolaro, you know, that's kind of different than having the kind of armchair approach to trying to figure out who shot Kennedy kind of a thing.
I mean, right.
Casolaro was sticking his finger on the pulse of the big monster that runs the world.
Hmm. He went for the guys that are never seen in the public, those who we never heard the names of, right?
That's right, yeah. And he used and he collected their names. And he was actually, you know, even though he was creating a fictional work, he didn't totally intended on putting those names in there. And when he talked to henchmen and assassins and people involved in the conspiracy, from their point of view, see, this was his big mistake. From their point of view, it didn't matter to them whether he was writing a book of fiction. All they knew was that there was this guy snooping around.
Right.
So eventually he was going to get whacked.
Hmm.
What happened?
And this was just, I guess, the Promise software and the whole InSlaw case here, this was just, I guess, one way into the entire network of the Octopus here, I guess, then.
That's right. That's precisely right. And, you know, it's kind of like the main thing. One interesting side note to all this is that at one point there was a television program in America, maybe you got it there, I don't know, called The Lone Gunman.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, it was like an offshoot of the X-Files.
Sure.
The X-Files series, right?
Yeah.
And it had three guys who were publishing a zine, right? You know, and I'd always pointed out to people before that these guys were me and Jim Martin and Greg Bishop, the three guys who were doing the three main conspiracy zines, trying to make us look ridiculous.
Right. Right.
Well, the very first episode of that show, and I didn't realize this actually until much later. I taped it and I didn't watch it because taped it because I'd heard that its plot involves something called the Octium chip, right? Octopus, Octium.
Mm.
And the Octium chip in the show was a piece of software that had backdoor access. They were obviously using the ideas that they picked up from the Octopus book, which was weird enough, you know, that, you know, what I'm doing, I'm watching on television. But the same episode, the very same episode, became real famous in the conspiracy circuit because later in the program, an airplane is headed toward the Trade Towers. And this is in the March preceding 9/11.
Right.
They had the whole scenario set up where this plane was going to crash into the Trade Towers. And they turn it around at the last minute using the promised software. So this whole scenario was getting played out on national television in the March preceding when it actually did happen. You know,
so
it wasn't turned away and we had 9/11.
What was the promise software actually mentioned in that episode?
It was called the Octium chip.
Okay, the Octium chip, but they didn't refer to it as promise in the series.
Promise, but it acted just like promise. It
right,
was
right.
Or access.
Yeah, right.
Octium reference and all that other stuff. It was kind of an oblique reference.
Very interesting indeed. Wasn't it Chris Carter who's behind Lone Gunman 2, wasn't it?
Yes, it was Chris Carter. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting guy for sure. He's got his finger on the pulse.
All these people. You know, and this was, you know, at one time it was almost common. There was another program called Dark Skies.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was on the Science Fiction Channel, which mixed up a lot of historical figures into this plot about MJ-12 and the aliens. Well, one week at steamshovelpress.com, I would do a column about Dorothy Kilgallen and her connection to the Kennedy assassination. The very next week, Dorothy Kilgallen was a character in that show. And then the next week, I write this article about Carl Sagan, who at one time argued before a rocket association that there were alien artifacts on the far side of the moon. And I put this in a column, and the next week in that show, Dark Skies, Carl Sagan was a character. He, you know, he'd been conscripted by MJ-12.
Right, right.
And Mel Gibson did a whole movie on conspiracy theory that and everything that Cab Driver is talking about in that movie all comes out of Steam Shovel Press because the writer, Brian Helgeland, I think his name was, had bought the book had bought the anthology. There are two anthologies of Steam Shovel Press, one of them called Popular Alienation, and the writer bought that book from Jim Martin in Flatland. So I got my $2 royalty for the book, and how many hundreds of thousands of dollars did Mel Gibson make off that?
Right.
Tell me there are no conspiracies.
Right. I mean, but this is interesting because we've discussed this before on the show that many writers, to this day, have a field day, so to speak, on the web that they're gathering a lot of information. In this case, obviously, it came from a book, but do you think that this means that they are paying close attention to your work and using it, or do you think that this is a synchronicity because the information itself actually wants to get out, so to speak?
Well, the definition of synchronicity, of course, is a meaningful coincidence.
Right.
So it may be a coincidence, but the meaningful part is really the kind of scary part. I'm sure they do monitor what kinds of information gets put out into the popular culture at any given time.
Mm.
And, you know, I used to have this discussion with Jim Keith, you know, it would come, we did a chapter on, we did a reference to Abbie Hoffman. Do you know Abbie Hoffman, the 60s radical figure?
Well, wasn't he the guy who was allegedly behind the whole LSD, you know, dissemination? Albert Hoffman, right?
No, that's Albert Hoffman. Albert Hoffman took LSD and took the famous bicycle ride, the first LSD trip. That was Albert.
Right.
Abbie Hoffman was a member of the Chicago Seven.
Uh-huh. Okay.
He was the 60s radical guy who was very popular dissenter in America.
Mm-hmm.
And he supposedly committed suicide, although there were a lot of questions about that. And at the very least, if he did commit suicide, it was because of partly because of pain that he was experiencing in his back after an auto accident that he got into when a truck forced his car off the road when he was trying to deliver a story about the Inslaw case to Playboy magazine.
Hmm.
Okay, so a lot of people suspect that he was killed, just like Casolaro. And the conversation with Keith went along the lines of, well, look, if they killed Casolaro and if they've killed Abbie Hoffman, you know, and Keith would say, Ken, how come they're not coming after us?
Right.
And first point to be made that this is not a conversation I can have with Jim Keith anymore, now is it?
No, exactly.
Yeah, and The second point is that, you know, why don't they just outright kill everybody who's a political dissenter? You know, just send hitmen out to every one of them.
Right.
And the answer is really because they have, you know, they have a big program going on. You know, there's a laughter curtain in the media. You try to talk about conspiracies in the American media, they will just laugh at you.
Right.
And so that's one way that they keep dissent in control. By those means, you know, there are financial means. There's all kinds of ways of getting at people, and different things happen at different times. So,
right. I guess that they're also kind of how should I put it? It's a need or a use for certain types of this information to exist within society, and as you said, this can be used either to make an example for other people. You know, this is, you know, these are an example of in quotes here, the kooks. You know what I mean? You know,
right, precisely.
Yeah,
and I've heard people make the arguments that things like the Zapruder film, for instance, were actually created. You know, the Zapruder film of the assassination of JFK.
Right. Yeah.
That was actually created for the very purpose of being able to play it over and over again in the media to remind, you know, people in the country that, hey, we can do this to anybody we want, anytime we want, and that it has kept, you know, certain control via fear that way.
It's a communication or a signal that is targeted more on the subconscious level, perhaps, that when people watch this, they're on some level supposed to know that, okay, there are some really, you know, big guys around here that absolutely have full control of the entire situation, right?
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, you know, particularly since I've been doing my work, conspiracy itself has been a theme in the popular culture. You know, X-Files and Lone Gunmen are just a couple of examples where people know that what's being said in these movies is fiction, is entertainment, it's a horror show one way or another. But on the other hand, it's also reflective of things that are really going on.
Right.
You know, so I don't know who made the point about the best way to keep a conspiracy covered up is to put it out in full view of everybody.
Well, exactly.
I think that's what happens. You know?
Yeah, because in that case, every single time someone would refer to that story or that that conspiracy, people would automatically revert to the idea that, no, that's just a movie, you know, or you're delusional, you know.
That's exactly right.
That's just a story, you know. That's nothing real about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. A lot of people just tell themselves. You know?
Of course. So, I mean, do you think, if we kind of go back a little bit and talk about the general outline, I guess, of the octopus, as you refer to it, the hidden power behind all the other hidden powers within government, so to speak. Would you say, you know, at this point that you have kind of figured out what the main agenda is, what's the purpose of the group is, what's their goal? Any ideas, theories that you want to share with us about that?
Well, I mean, you could talk about it in kind of general terms. You know, there's a shifting agendas. You know, different things to be done at different times. You know, maybe its biggest expression was the 9/11 event itself, which a lot of people have characterized as, you know, having been done by the Bush administration itself. You know, there are people out there who don't even believe, for instance, that Al-Qaeda is real, that it's some kind of creation of our own Western intelligence. And, you know,
right.
You can see in the historical record, you can see that its earliest incarnations were, in fact, funded by the U.S. It's a big New Brzezinski says this in his memoirs.
That's right.
Started funding the Mujahideen before even the Soviets invaded Afghanistan.
Yeah.
You know, which was supposedly their purpose. And that, you know, you can take the money and run with it. I don't go all the way there with all these people. You know, I'm not a person, for instance, that doesn't believe or believes that no plane hit the Pentagon. I know the Pentagon was hit by a plane. It's
how do you know that?
Fact, but
how do you know that?
Clear. What's that?
How do you know that?
Well, let's see. One thing I did was interview, along with John Judge and Lynn Bracken, we went to the hotel that's right across from the Pentagon, and we interviewed everybody that worked there that day, and to a person, they all saw a plane, a large jetliner. They didn't see a cruise missile or a drone. There's also a series of photographs that were taken by a gas station, the Citgo station, across from the Pentagon that clearly shows the airline's logo on the back of the plane.
Are these photos available online or anything so we can look at those?
Yeah, actually, most people seem to think it's weird. People seem to think it's footage, the Sitco footage. It's not. It's a series of photographs. But yeah, the Sitco station is out there. And there's all kinds. I mean, you can.
So do you know where we can look for them on the web right now? Because I really want to look at them because I've never seen them before. If they're not the ones that I'm still thinking of, those three frames or whatever that was released by the Pentagon for a few year ago or whatever it was?
From the Sitco station.
Right, okay.
Yeah, just do 9/11 Sitco.
Right, okay.
Look at that. But again, we go back to the interviews. And if you go to D.C., you know, and talk to any 20 people, you'll find one who is a witness to what happened there. But, let me add, too, though, to a person, all these people, and we even talked to, the janitorial staff. You know, Len Bracken was bilingual, so he was picking this up from people who spoke only Spanish. But to a person, they all said that the very next day, the FBI came to the hotel and confiscated all the surveillance footage.
Mm-hmm.
So there really is a lot more footage than the Sitco station footage, but they don't even admit that they have it, you know. It's clearly there.
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI will do things, or these police agencies will do things that in that way almost automatically. It's kind of a bureaucratic self-preservation thing. We're going to take these tapes just to see if we have any involvement in it.
Right.
And so, you know, there's certainly a lot more footage that they're covering up that could settle the issue one way or another.
Hmm.
So there's some agenda being put forward there to keep that story alive.
Okay, well, I guess we could argue here, you know, all night long, because at this point, at least myself, I'm not convinced by what I've seen so far about a plane hitting the Pentagon And there's, you know, again, so many people out there fighting over this, and at some point, okay, it's obviously interesting for in regards to the, you know, seeking the objective truth about this event and so forth, but I guess what you know really concerns me is the consequence of whatever it was that hit the Pentagon. That is of most importance at this point. Would you agree on that?
Precisely. Well, actually, really, my sense of it is, and what I have to say is supported by congressional testimony as well, is that it started to happen, and Cheney, who's like the real power, right? George Bush, just the puppet head. Cheney sees it happening around him and says, hey, this is something I can work with, and he orders a stand down. And so I do believe that 9/11 was the product of the jihad conspiracy, but mm-hmm. it kind of worked in tandem with the goals of the people who were in power at that time. So,
okay, so they hired a small group within this movement in order to carry out this attack. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Okay.
I don't see any real evidence for that. I will say this, though, about Danny Pearl is one important figure in this whole thing. You know, the reporter who was beheaded, right?
Mm.
Danny Pearl was working for the Wall Street Journal. What he was looking for at that point was evidence of a payoff made to the head of the ISI, which is the Pakistani Secret Service.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was forced to resign because it was eventually exposed that he made a $10,000 payoff to Mohammed Atta. So Danny Pearl was investigating where that money came from, and it may indeed have come from Western sources. We don't know because, boom, the same thing happened to Danny Pearl that happened to Danny Casolaro.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, yeah.
So there's reasons to suspect that, but we can't really say, you know, right now anyway, we can't really say that's what happened. We, you know, more research and proof needs to be done.
Right,
along those
right.
lines. And you know, and it's also it's one of the things that happens in this country is that people get so focused on Bush and cronies that they lose sight of the fact that the whole world is covered with this conspiracy business. You know,
mm-hmm.
there are all kinds of conspiracies. It's not just George Bush, although Casolaro did identify George Bush the first as one of the members of the Octopus, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine. Oh, God.
That's not the only conspiracy out there, and, you know, it's patently absurd, you know, to really say that, you know, that there is no Al-Qaeda, that there is no jihad, that, you know, that Iran isn't conspiring to overthrow Israel and those kinds of things. Those are all conspiracies worthy of study and discussion.
It all depends, I guess, on who you talk to and at what level that particular person is. As you say, I think you're absolutely right when you say that there's all kinds of agendas on different levels. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, at least, it seems to point to, the evidence seems to point at, the further up the agenda you go, the further up the ladder or the pyramid or whatever you want to phrase it, it's an overarching conspiracy, if you will, that actually are influencing and in some level controlling all the minor conspiracies on the level below, and the media sometimes pick up on a conspiracy on you know, just a very, you know, not so high up on the agenda, so to speak, and run with that, and people become obsessed and concerned with that for a while. But I think the important thing is to always to kind of see the big picture, and as you say, not be kind of deluded by the small minute details, although that they might be very important in certain cases. That should be pointed out too, of course.
Oh, I agree with you totally. I think what we're talking about, and what Danny Cancellara was talking about, trying to get across the idea of the octopus, is that it is structural, you know, that it's not a bunch of rogue conspiracies that kind of happen every once in a while. It is the way that the major power groups on this planet do business.
Right, right. And I mean, at this point, in regards to the documents and so forth that Casalero had left you with, so to speak, any names there, real names on who's real behind the biggest conspiracy of all?
We do have a chapter in the book called Hagiography, which is Lives of the Saints, but I guess in this case it's the Lives of the Sinners. And there's a whole list of the people that formed the original octopus.
Okay.
Again, it's like you were saying before, they created a structure, a bureaucracy, and there are people, there are still people from there. You know, there's still some of the original group has still got its hand in it, but, you know, they've got other people there now whose names you could recognize or not. I mean, one of the big things, one of the big political scandals that has happened since the octopus, I see when the octopus came out in the late 90s, you know, and here we are in 2008.
Right.
And one of the big political scandals that's going on, one of the very interesting ones, is the Valerie Plame, Ed Wilson case. Are you familiar with that at all?
Yeah.
Now, here's a clear case where actually what you see going on is counter to the war. The secret elements that exist don't want the Iraq war. They were happier when Saddam Hussein was simply their puppet. And Ed Wilson kind of totally misreported the idea that Saddam was trying to purchase yellow cake uranium from Niger. And some documents, some fake documents that established this relationship, but they were so clearly faked and discredited that they discredited the relationship. And there was every clear indication, when you look at the history of the thing and who these people were meeting with, that Saddam was indeed going after yellow cake uranium and trying to you know, get back on the path to a nuclear bomb.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, here we've got these fake documents that disprove that. Well, who plants fake documents? This is the very fingerprints of the octopus trying to subvert Bush's foreign policy, which everybody abhors. So it's kind of counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
It almost seems as if the octopus is on the side of the people who are opposed to war, but they're not. They just thought it was a much better, and that's why Saddam survived all those times. You know, even when we fought the Persian Gulf War, we left him in power.
Hmm. Well, I see what you mean, but at some level too, I'm kind of seeing. I'm seeing lies within lies. You know what I mean? It's like this is like a front. You know we. This is like, because, again, I always become kind of automatically suspicious, I guess, and that's not a good way to go approach that, perhaps, but kind of intuitively, I'm kind of, as soon as the media picks up on something like this, like the Plame Gate or whatever they actually call it at that time, Valerie Plame, that story, it's all over the media, everyone is reporting it, and that is also for a reason. That's how I see it. That's also for a reason. Why is this particular case being highlighted when there's so many other things, right?
Right. It's got to be a deflection, you know, get people to pay attention to this one while everything else is going on.
Yeah,
I agree with you on general principles. And actually, when you think about it, the idea, again, of the forged documents, that got some media play, but it hasn't gotten the big media play that the overall Wilson-Plame scandal did. And I should mention, too, that one of the big players in the plane scandal is clearly identified by Casolaro as a member of the Octopus, and that's Richard Armitage, who supposedly was the first person to leak plane's name. So there you have it. You know, there you have it. Richard Armitage, who was, according to Bo Grice, and I hope some of this information doesn't get too arcane. A lot of people who are well-versed in conspiracy theory can follow this, but if there's others out there who can't, just try to bear with me. There was a man named Bo Grice who was sent over to Southeast Asia to investigate whether there were connections between the drug lords there and the drug running in Southeast Asia and the American government.
Mm-hmm.
And Bo Grice produced a tape, a videotape, and a presidential candidate named Ross Perot was kind of behind the funding on this.
Right.
Bo Grice produced a tape of an interview with a drug lord named Khun Sa, who said quite clearly, with Bo Grice pointing to the picture, that his contact within the U.S. government, for people who were profiteering off of the heroin trade in Southeast Asia, was Richard Armitage, the same guy who's now supposedly leaked Valerie Plame's name, the same guy who's probably behind the forged documents trying to discredit the idea that Hussein was looking for yellowcake uranium.
Right. But
yeah.
And also, this is very interesting, very, very interesting. And of course, but one has to also, be reminded that Richard Armitage is not, when he's leaking these documents, he's not perhaps doing that as a member of the Octopus group, but he's doing that as the, deputy secretary of state or whatever he was at that time.
He is an official. Well, when he's leaking documents, of course, you can't officially leak a document. That's kind of
exactly. But I mean, it's
he's supposedly a big respected official in the Bush administration.
Yes, I mean, it's like that's the guy who's behind it, not the guy who's involved in a bigger conspiracy within a larger group here. Because nobody knows about that, right?
Well, yeah. Well, it's underplayed. I mean, you really have to look for it. Another recent example was Barack Obama. In the turban photograph, did you follow that at all?
I saw that briefly. Just the photo, it just kind of flashed by my news desk, right, so to speak. But yeah, sure.
The photograph of Barack Obama in Kenya, dressed in Islamic attire,
right,
robes, and right, got to be a big scandal in the U.S. presidential race. Because people are afraid that really Barack Obama is secretly a Muslim, and my God, we couldn't have one of those for president. But the parapolitics behind that, and I should explain that, where parapolitics is the name of one of my books, and it's the term that I use instead of conspiracy theory, because conspiracy theory is so ridiculed in the media.
Right.
The parapolitics behind that particular instance was in Kenya, there was a power struggle with a man named Odinga, who actually identified himself as a cousin of Barack Obama, who was vying for power there in Kenya, who had developed something called an MOA with local Muslim clerics, a Memorandum of Understanding. And what was surfacing at that time was that Memorandum of Understanding said that if Odinga got any kind of power in Kenya, that he would help to impose Sharia law on Kenya. Well, it turned out that Memorandum of Understanding was faked. There was another one that said quite the opposite, that these clerics were pushing for greater cooperation among all the ethnic groups. And so buried deep down, there's another fake document, another footprint, just as with the yellowcake uranium. You see some indication, and there you see some indication that maybe these Octopus, these intelligence sources, kind of conceive of Barack Obama as some kind of a threat, so let's start planning documents, let's start creating controversy.
I hear what you're saying, but what about this idea also, though, that since this top group knows exactly where the game is being played because they are behind it, they are rigging the game, the only way to make sure that they have all the pieces in place and also that everyone below them, underneath them, should be totally confused about what the real agenda is. No one is at any point to actually be 100% certain of where this is going. And since you're controlling the game, rigging the game, the only way to achieve that is to actually flood, if you will, the below levels with all kinds of rumors on every single level that exists. And this creates a general kind of confusion, which means that everyone is a total, you know, disillusion about what's going on, who's controlling the game. And this is also a way for them to actually cover up their tracks and even to cover up the agenda of where they're going.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the national debate about the presidential elections in this country is just ridiculous, you know, and deliberately so. And it doesn't have anything to do with any real issues that affect any real citizens of this country.
Right.
And that's kind of why I advocate for this whole approach of trying to look for those kinds of fingerprints. I mean, it's a tough thing to do.
Yeah, sure.
You know, to find some kind of clue in a totally brainwashing kind of media system.
Sure.
That gets you back to the reality of what's going on. But, you know, to me, that seems to be the exercise that's necessary for any thinking person to try to struggle back to some kind of, you know, idea that they're living in the free world.
Absolutely. You know what we'll need to do like this, that we need to begin to round things off here on the first segment, and we're going to definitely talk more. I want to ask you in the next segment here more about the kind of the main agendas you see it right now and where we're heading and if they're successful, and also, of course, if this leads into other areas, because if there's time, I do want to talk about a little bit about William Reich and the UFOs, and again, if there's a connection with the UFOs here, that's always interesting. But before we round things off here, though, I first want to mention that you will be upcoming on the conference in Liverpool, in England, the 3rd and 4th of May. It's again called the Beyond Knowledge Conference. So if you who are listening is interested in hearing Ken talk or some of the other guys there, like Marcus Allen, David Hatcher Childress, Jerry E. Smith, Michael Tesserion, Ralph Ellis, Ian Crane, and David Griffin, those are the guys who's going to speak there. Head on over to their website and check out more information there. It's about tickets, times, etc., etc. It's beyond-knowledge.co.uk. Again, that's beyond-knowledge.co.uk. And Ken, as I understand it, you will be speaking both of the days. Is that right?
That's right, yes. I actually have two talks I'm giving. As you said, one's going to be on Wilhelm Reich and UFOs, and we'll be studying the history of the Eisenhower administration and the military-industrial complex. And the other talk will be on the Maury Island UFO, which connects the 1947 UFO event with a 1968 investigation of the JFK assassination.
Fascinating indeed. Yeah, it's going to be very fun, and myself and Fredrik is going to be there too. It's going to be nice hooking up with you guys, so I guess we'll see each other over there then, Ken.
Okay, sounds fabulous.
Tune into our continuation with Ken Thomas. Head on over to our website, redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E creations.com. And click on subscribe to find out how to sign up and tune in. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks to Fredrik out in the control room. Heads up for our interview with Michael Tesserion this coming Sunday. We'll take a short break, but we'll be right back with more of Ken Thomas.